From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, you have helped get us on the air and stay on the air. We are grateful for that. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
Let's be honest with the American people. It was not an insurrection.
I don't know who did a poll that is Trump supporters.
In fact, it was Trump supporters who lost their lives that day.
2,000 police officers were injured from BLM riots last year.
The outrageously partisan response since the dangerous attack on our nation's capital and the peaceful transfer of power itself on January 6th ought to terrify every patriotic American. The thinking, though, seems to be as long as they're our seditious terrorists, it's not really that bad. And the Republican lawmakers who refuse to vote for an investigation into a movement that almost cost many of them their actual lives seem comforted by its failure. This time, anyway. But for a growing number of nationalists, often spurred on by their extreme understanding of Christianity, chaos, upheaval, and bloodshed are long-term goals on their way to a very different, fractured, and submissive America. I'll talk with Political Research Associate Senior Research Analyst Fred Clarkson, who recently co-authored a chilling report for Religion Dispatches headlined Convergence of Far-Right Anti-Democratic Factions in the Northwest Could Provide a Model for the Rest of the Nation.
God is going to prevail in humanity, and maybe God will use churches. Amen.
Over the years, the Reverend Dr. Donna Scopper has been a regular voice on this program. With broad engagement in the work of social justice, 38 books to her credit, and the role of senior minister at a busy New York City church, Judson Memorial, as her day job since 2005, Donna keeps incredibly busy. And so it should surprise no one that as she steps down from her leadership position at Judson Memorial, Donna Scopper is not talking about retirement. She's talking about rewirement. To see what she's got in mind for the future, I'm looking forward to spending some time together on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
our goal is to create opportunities of allyship with the queer community, Black and Brown communities, and congregations by encouraging congregations nationwide to participate in our pro-equality sponsored events during Pride Month.
As various inclusive communities and organizations acknowledge and celebrate Pride Month this June, a coalition of faith and activist groups are leveraging the occasion for practical organizing, training, and action. After all, there are powerful forces aligned against LGBTQI plus rights and identity in this country, often shrouded in religious language and complicated by racial and economic inequality that won't be deterred by a party or by a parade. This June, Interfaith Alliance is partnering with a number of organizations and religious groups for the Colors Pride Initiative, and I'm happy to have one of the organizers with us today to get an overview of what's going on. The Reverend Dr. Roland Stringfellow is a pastor in the Metropolitan Community Church and board president of Inclusive Justice in Detroit, Michigan. Roland, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
It is an honor and a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
The idea is to think about pride outside of the box. Now, what does that mean?
Absolutely. You know, because of the pandemic, this is now the second year many communities are not able to have parades or festivals during the month of June. Granted, many restrictions are being lifted, but that was not in enough time to allow organizers to do that. So last year, as this year, we had to be creative and think, how can we continue to show our pride but have to do it outside of the box? This year, what we have decided to do, rather than to simply sit on our, you know, our hands and twiddle our thumbs, let's engage congregations that are welcoming, that are open and affirming, that are reconciling, to say, do something for equality this year. And so that is how the Colors of Pride campaign was birthed.
I see.
After the horrendous year we have had in 2020, with all that has happened, in fact, I call it the apocalypse of the four P's, the letter P, with dealing with the pandemic, of course, dealing with the politics or the political situation in the United States that was just horrific for many of us, mm-hmm. particularly, you know, culminating on January 6th.
Yeah.
Then you had policing and protesting that happened. And myself, as an African-American person, that took a particular toll on my psyche, you know, just mm-hmm. watching, you know, and hearing name after name, body after body being, you know, assaulted. Yeah. And then the fourth P is really, I would say, anything personal that you had going on with you. Like, we all had something personal in terms of making that shift. So because of those four apocalyptic, you know, things that occurred, how is it that we can do something that feels not just ordinary, like we've done this before? So the Colors of Pride is what I'm calling intersectional equality, because we have grown to know over this past year, and the pandemic has taught us many lessons, that we are not alone. We are definitely interconnected with one another. Mm. And so for us solely to say, let's celebrate pride, yay, but then ignore what's happening with many of the legislative, you know, assaults that are happening on the LGBT community, mm. we can't do that. Mm. For us to say, yay, pride, but then ignore the injustice against Black and brown bodies, or yay, pride, but then a particular section of your community, the transgender population, especially Black trans women, you know, being insulted, and let alone just even what many states are currently doing with, you know, sports bans, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, trans youth. Right. There are so many different things to think about. And then, you know, obviously the assault on, you know, reproductive rights. So there has to be an intersection, and that is what this Colors of Pride is all about. Hmm. Recognizing that each of us have a very distinct identity that we are very proud of, but almost like a reverse spectrum, that when those colors come together, we make one strong beam of light, hmm. and let's all come together. And so what I like to say, this is a time of allyship. Mm-hmm. And to have the queer community and Black and brown communities, as well as congregations, to come together to do something that will truly make a difference in the lives of others.
What are the events, some of the events lined up for the week of June 11th specifically, and the entire month of June more generally?
Absolutely. Let me begin with the general question first. So I like to say we're going to do vertical and horizontal programming. Beginning with the vertical, during each of the weekends that congregations are meeting for their religious services, we have assembled a great line of national religious leaders to create a short video recording of explaining this intersectional equality and why it is so very important. So we have, you know, leaders from Judaism and Christianity and Unitarian Universalists and myself, you know, giving an introduction. So each of the four weekends during Pride Month, we are encouraging congregations to either show the video at the top of their service. If that's not what they do, that's not, you know, their practice, then maybe they can show, you know, at least post it on their website and or Facebook page. Mm-hmm. But we simply want to, that's the easiest way for a congregation to participate. We're looking for literally over 300 congregations across the United States. And when you think about it, that's not a big number. But if we can get those congregations truly engaged and saying, we want to take this stand for equality, yeah, then we are very happy. So that's the vertical. The horizontal is what you reference, which we're calling the Colors of Pride Week. And so it begins actually the weekend before on the 11th, 12th, and 13th, that weekend. Mm-hmm. We are encouraging congregations to either preach or teach or have a special session or even a bulletin insert when it comes to this topic of intersectional equality and to call the attentions of their community to the various challenges that many vulnerable populations experience. Because again, I'm just going to repeat myself for a moment, but it bears repeating, that when it comes to Pride Month, we can solely be, we can feel good about ourselves if we hang the rainbow flag or if we march in the parade or we do something with the LGBT community to show our solidarity. What we want for that first weekend is say, take a step further and to say, you know, more than just simply, yay, we put the flag out, but we want to organize our congregations to do something a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So then beginning that Monday, which is the 14th of June, Monday the 14th, we are inviting congregations to meet us and join us online for a live training on how to, in a sense, amplify their voices and to be educated on the variety of equality issues that are out there, from the Equality Act, also to the upcoming Supreme Court decision on Fulton versus Philadelphia, and the like. So then throughout the goal of that evening is that when once a congregation engages, they will walk away with some really great skills on how to contact their legislator, how to write an op-ed, how to really, you know, again, amplify their voice and to increase their public witness for equality. The balance of the week will be a variety of focuses from the George Floyd Policing Act, mm-hmm, to how to support the transgender community. And then I'm going to be doing a workshop midweek called Speak, Schedule, and Script. It's how congregations can, from the very beginning, to take an interest, how to contact your legislative representative, and then how to actually conduct the meeting. And so I've have done that workshop multiple times, and we want folks to understand that. I've also partnered with the LGBT Task Force in a webinar, which is called Turning a Sermon into a Soundbite. Mm. Because we recognize that, like I'm doing right now, preachers can be very verbose, you know, ministers can be very verbose. And how is it that you can't say it all, but how do you, you know, pare it down in a way that's an elevator speech to capture the attention of your audience, whether it is in an op-ed or whether you're sitting in front of your legislator, yeah, to communicate that. Lastly, we're going to then have on June 19th a national celebration of Juneteenth. And we felt that this was a great capstone to all that we're doing, because for your listeners who may have heard of Juneteenth but not know really what it was, it mm-hmm. is the day of emancipation where the final enslaved African Americans received the word in Texas that they indeed were emancipated mm-hmm. by the Emancipation Proclamation. And we're going to have a YouTube premiere where anyone can tune in at 12 noon Eastern or 9 a.m. Pacific to engage in the Juneteenth celebration.
It's obvious that to a great extent, the campaign targets faith leaders and congregations. Why is that the focus of Colors of Pride?
Absolutely. Great question. You know, because we recognize that, the city of Jackson, Michigan, which is on the west side of the state, had a forum last night that I spoke on. The mayor was there, an Episcopal bishop, and representatives from the ACLU. And the city of Jackson, what they wanted to do is they recognized that the oppositions that they are facing for human rights are coming from religious leaders on the more conservative end of that spectrum. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I shared with the audience last evening was that those of us who are more moderate, those of us who are more progressive, but basically we don't want to see religion used as a weapon mm-hmm. to downtrod anyone in our community. I call that spiritual violence. When you take the name of God or any type of religion or religious community to condemn or to shun somebody, religious mm-hmm. violence. So how is it that we can combat that? And it is good for us who are moderates, who are progressive when it comes to our religious practices, to say religion will not be used in this way. And it doesn't necessarily mean you have to agree with the quote-unquote progressive agenda, political agenda. But it's just to say that, you know, we believe in the separation of church and state, and that we don't want someone from the outside coming in telling us how to do our religious practices, and thus no one religion should then impose their beliefs on others. Yeah. And so we're going to stand up for that. And so that is the reason why we have targeted for our audience religious leaders. Mm-hmm. And we very well may have, quote unquote, you know, evangelicals or you know, those who consider themselves more conservative joining this campaign, not because they believe in, you know, LGBT equality, but they do support, to say, the separation of church and state. And that is what we are hoping will be the outcome.
Roland, how would you describe the coalition promoting this campaign, and how did this broad coalition come together?
Well, you know, I have to really thank my friends at the Interfaith Alliance, because what they do, they host a bi-monthly conference call with other religious organizers who are doing work for equality. So we meet and we recognize that, you know, this storm is swirling. You know, as I mentioned earlier about the Supreme Court's decision around Fulton in Philadelphia and the Equality Act. And again, you know, just, you know, the assault on black and brown bodies. And we just recognized we needed to do something outside the box. And so when we added the component to say, let's go beyond just simply the LGBT equality, but then to expand it to racial justice and equality, as well as gender justice. Many of those same partners were, you know, thrilled and said, yes, that is something I want to sign on for. And so that was something that I, myself and some others who are part of that coalition have been meeting, you know, doing double time to organize this and put together a toolkit of resources. So even if a congregation is not able to engage in all the things that I listed. If they sign up through equalitytime.org/colorsofpride, they will get the toolkit of everything that I'm sharing with you, and they can, and, you know, in a sense, do this. So our partners are sending out the ask to their networks, their congregations, and inviting them to participate.
To be honest, this month we're seeing the word pride just about everywhere, more than I've ever seen it. What would you urge people to focus on during this time of celebration so as not to get distracted by well-intentioned but sometimes overwhelming messages?
That's a very important question, especially, you know, you have to answer that question in light of all the various restrictions around the pandemic being lifted. Many of us have been so tired by being isolated and, you know, not being in community. And, you know, we want to rip off our mask and run to the beach and just, you know, and have a grand old time. But you know, as the medical professionals are letting us know, you got to be cautious. You just can't just run back out because the virus is still out there and the virus is still real. And I would say it to answer your question that we can't necessarily simply erase all of the events of the past year. And so, you know, to just have pride as we've always done it is really sticking your head back in the sand. It's like, what impact has this pandemic had upon your heart and your life and your community? And how will pride look different? Not diminished, but different. Like I said, pride outside the box. In the same way about the intersectionality with other communities that, you know, it's like to just solely turn your head and look in one corner while all this other horrendous actions are happening in other parts of the world or even your own community is sticking your head in the sand.
Yeah.
And so as we talk about pride, it's pride for everyone, that everyone needs to have their head lifted. Everyone needs to have their heart raised. And so for those who really have the heart to really want to, you know, have embrace and be in community, then be in community in a way to help heal people from the events of this, you know, past year and a half, because we all need that helping hand. And that is how this pride can look different.
The Reverend Dr. Roland Stringfellow is senior pastor and teacher at the Metropolitan Community Church of Detroit and board president of Inclusive Justice. Roland, happy Pride. And
happy
thank
Pride
you
to me.
For being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Indeed. Again, it's my pleasure, and happy Pride to all your listeners.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, the Reverend Dr. Donna Scopper on her rewirement after 15 years of leadership at Judson Memorial Church in New York City. And later, convergence of far-right anti-democratic factions, Fred Clarkson reports. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. When you look at the greatest moral initiatives of our time, the sanctuary movement, LGBTQI plus equality, economic justice, reproductive rights, and the list goes on, you won't have to look long before you find noteworthy contributions from my next guest. The author of 38 books, the Reverend Dr. Donna Scopper, is stepping down after 15 years as senior minister at Judson Memorial Church in New York, but characteristically is calling this a rewirement rather than a retirement. Now, with that in mind, I am delighted to have this opportunity to welcome her back to State of Belief Radio. Donna, thank you for being with us again.
It's my pleasure. I'm so glad you invited me.
Why now? What prompted you to take this step now?
Just a wonderful sense of completion at Judson. I felt that my work was done, or at least done enough that others could take over and handle it. But also COVID did to me what it does to everybody. It forces you into this deep reckoning with yourself. And I suppose if there's a sidebar to it, I was so reconvinced about racism being the central question of the land. And a sin for which we have not fully repented. And I was a little tired of being in a really deep blue congregation where everybody agreed with me about that. And Judson has had the luxury of becoming more integrated in the last couple of decades. And so we're actually doing some remarkable inner work about becoming less of a white congregation and more of an integrated congregation. And the leadership was in place to do that. And we're also blessed with extraordinary queer leadership, extraordinary young women's leadership, et cetera. And I couldn't figure out what an experienced old white woman was doing there anymore. So I thought, maybe you could have another challenge and find a way to live in a more purple environment and be challenged by it, learn from it, and figure out how did President Trump happen? What drove that? Can it happen again? And I'm actually fairly good at turning congregations around. I'm a turnaround specialist, it appears, with seven behind me. And I thought, well, maybe I've got the energy at 74 to do one more. So that's the complex reasoning.
How has the landscape for public ministry and social justice activism changed through these 15 years? And how is New York City different today?
I think that New York has always been at the forefront of multiple movements and always been a place where land and place and real estate mattered fundamentally. The one project I'm taking with me is a project called Bricks and Mortals, which has to do with more place-based, locally engaged, adaptive reuse of sacred sites, places where people can gather. That's really been the secret to Judson's success, that it kept the doors wide open and it used every closet and every corridor and every room to allow people to come together. And public ministry, I think, is even more dependent in the age of, I call it Zumbaya, more dependent on places where people can do self-governance and gather as the prelude to genuine democracy. So the way I would put it is, I'm not against community organizing at all. I think it's fundamental. But I think that younger, especially queer people who are so magnificently creative and involved in all the movements are showing us a way to be communal in other ways and getting that big word intersectionality. It's much too big and it's not a pretty word. The way the exhaustion of masculinity and therefore the exhaustion of stereotypical notions of femininity are underneath all this insecurity that drives injustice. And I don't mean to psychoanalyze so much as to say that if we can learn from not only our own experience, but each other's experience, things could get really interesting really quick. And add to that the fact that I don't think racism, I was just talking with an interracial couple yesterday doing premarital counseling. And I said, so what do you think is going to happen to your interracial child? And they both said, she's going to be fine. They're going to be fine. And I said, what makes you think it's going to change? And they said, because number one, we don't allow people to mess with us. But number two, the population is going to tip and the old angry people are just not going to have a constituency. That we're in the last gasps. And I think that could be true.
Well, let me personalize now at this point, Donna. How have you been changed by these years of pastoral ministry and activism?
So in my final sermon at Judson, I said, I call it farewell, and fair is means journey, but it also means the cost of the trip. How did you fare? Was the food expensive? Was, you know, the lodging decent? And what does wellness mean? And fair, I said, I gave everything I had to Judson Memorial Church, and I used five metaphors. One was, I made quadruple the return on my investment. It was like going to show up for a bus and thinking you're going to have to grab a cab, but every time you needed a bus, one just arrived. New leadership emerged. I felt that I was at a constant feast, and not that everything we did turned to gold, but that everything we did multiplied its power by virtue of the participation of those who were there. Mm-hmm. So I called it my investment, my risky investment, my needing a bus, my being a bus driver that nobody threw up on and everybody thanked all day long. I had just these kind of, I just felt so blessed by Judson.
Yeah.
And so probably what changed for me is I finally found some people who I could really cook with.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I had been in purple congregations.
Yeah.
And they always thought I was too radical, and Judson always thought I was too conservative.
Could you identify one program or achievement that you're the most gratified by?
I know that the ticket to our success at Judson, and emphasize our, was the community ministry program. And I'll tell you the story of it. When I got there, we had about 60 people. Nothing worked. We were down to one bathroom that functioned. And I said to the board, I got to have an intern. I got to have somebody. I have to work with somebody. So we put a note out at Union Seminary, and we got, I think it was 6 or 7 applications. And I jokingly said to a woman named Peggy Halsey, who was on the board and running the search for the intern, said, Peggy, they're all so good. I think we should hire all of them. And she said, let's do it. And so we hired them. And from that, and through the generosity of the Carpenter Family Foundation, we had 15 years of 14 cohorts of community ministries, ministers, and they turned the place around. And they did it by being a group of young people that you'd see when you came in, so young people didn't feel like surrounded by their grandparents. Mm-hmm. They did it by being absolute brilliant soldiers in all in Occupy, in Sanctuary, in Bricks and Mortals, in Reproductive Rights, in Queer, in Arts. They did it. And we graduated 109 people from that program. And one of my friends says that they were scopperized. And I think that's a terrible word for it. But what we really did was imitate group learning every Friday afternoon for 3 hours and had the best conversations. And then we went back to work. So we had an army.
Yeah. You have worked with so many seminarians or ordained so many future leaders during your time at Judson. What inspires you about the people being called to ministry today?
They're really honest. They don't want any BS. They really can't. They can smell an instrument or an ad a mile away. And they'd rather hear bad news than false news. And I've often mused on, you know, a lot of us in our generation make fun of the language spiritual but not religious, right?
Yeah.
I have learned not to make fun of it, but to say, what you're saying is you don't want to lie about God.
Yeah.
And you don't want to say words that don't mean anything. And I think that's really beautiful.
Oh, I do too. Yeah. And you've said it well. Donna, your next book is titled Remove the Pews. I'd love to hear something about that book and this movement.
Well, all right. It's obviously a joke. I mean, it's not to be taken literally, although we have been removing pews around the country because in our organization, Bricks and Mortals, and the reason is that when you remove the pews, you can use the sacred space 7 days a week, and you can set for a big group or a small group or a concert or a dance. My favorite program at Judson was the Morning Glories, where 500 kids who wanted to dance sober would show up at 7 a.m. and dance their heads off for 2 hours. If the pews were there, they couldn't do that, right? And so many of our good programs had to do with harm reduction. But what's beautiful about our space is how empty it is. But if you want to set the room for 35 people in the middle of the room, you can set it. It doesn't mean you don't sit down, but you can use the space in lots of different ways. And what I really mean in the book, removethepews.com, is you got to get that rigidity out of our theology as well as out of our buildings.
So rewirement, not retirement. You've mentioned a little of what's coming. Talk about what else you're planning to do next, if you would.
I'm going to do three things. I'm going to be the half-time, part-time pastor where I am right now at the Orient Congregational Church on the east end of Long Island, the oldest congregational church in New York State, 300 years. We were just at the bank this morning trying to talk Chase into getting us a new checking account. And every time we plugged in the 1840, they said, the computer said, no, that we couldn't get the account. And it's a congregation in a, like every other place in the entire country. It is rapidly changing. It's run by quite a few lesbian couples and quite a few farmers. And there's a huge influx of urban exiles out to this beautiful strip on the North Fork. It's not the South Fork. That's where all the rich people go. The North Fork is a little different. And I've always wanted to come out here. I had a church in Riverhead for nearly a decade, and I fell in love with this place. So I'm going to be doing that. And I wouldn't call them a turnaround because they've never been very big. You know, it's just it's an interesting place. But we're already at work on big houses and limiting lot size for all these McMansions coming out here, called the Big House Movement. I'm going to continue teaching at Hartford Seminary, where I've been teaching for 7 or 8 years. And I was teaching in the Doctor of Ministry program, but unfortunately they killed that program. So now I'm teaching in the chaplaincy program. And half of the people I'm teaching are Muslims, which is fascinating to me. So it's really a wonderful place for... The other thing I love about this coming generation is how automatically interfaith they are.
Yeah.
They have absolutely no allegiance to one brand of religion, and they think God is larger. And then I'm going to be working in these five cities, reproducing the Judson model of hyperuse of sacred space. Plugging into a new energy source is what it means.
Yeah.
Judson was a great energy source for me. And when it was complete, it was complete. And I'm looking for some new energy sources.
Reverend Dr. Donna Scopper is a prolific author, an inspired preacher, and a powerful voice for justice and moral inclusivity, who's been tireless in her activism for as long as I've known her. Donna, thank you so much for taking the time, and I hope we can continue it on State of Belief Radio.
I hope so, too. It's wonderful to see you.
The media have done a pretty good job portraying the seditious invaders of the U.S. Capitol in early January as a cartoonish band of ragtag oafs. Were that entirely true, we could count ourselves as lucky. But in reality, there are far more tactical and far less visible threats brewing right now, and a chilling report on one such threat appeared recently in Religion Dispatches under the headline, "Convergence of Far-Right Anti-Democratic Factions in the Northwest Could Provide a Model for the Rest of the Nation." The authors are Fred Clarkson and Chloe Cooper, and I am very thankful to have Fred back with us again to discuss this. Fred, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me back. It's always good to chat with you.
Among the most striking themes of this frightening report is the collusion between current and former elected officials and aggressively anti-democratic figures, some but not all religiously identified. What does that collusion look like in the schemes that you write about?
Well, I came to this particular story because, as you know, we've talked about, there's a Christian right state legislative campaign called Project Blitz, which is taking model bills constructed by a national organization called the Congressional Prayer Caucus Foundation and trying to slip them into state legislatures as a part of a larger political building program towards a kind of Christian dominion. Mm-hmm. But what surprised me, and this is where the convergence is, that the state chairman of the Washington State Legislative Prayer Caucus, and that's the action arm of Project Blitz, organization of state legislators. And it sounds like it's just about prayer, but they have a legislative agenda. But this is where I was shocked, Wilton, that it was chaired by Matt Shea, who had been previously involved in this right-wing military takeover of a federal wildlife refuge, the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. And he was, it turned out, he'd been involved in the planning, you know, as well as support for this operation. And he's very involved in far-right militia-type movements all around the Pacific Northwest, and including secessionist movements that he's been operating with for a long time. So it's one thing to have a Christian right legislative agenda. It's a democratic process. You may or may not like it, but at least it's well within the scope of what we understand democracy to be. Mm-hmm. This is using the democratic platform of state of a being a state legislative official to launch insurrectionary movements.
What's the vision or visions that we're talking about here?
Well, there are several kinds of factions who I think are trying to figure out how they can work together towards their common goal. And in the case of we had Matt Shea, the state legislator, the chairman of the Prayer Caucus, and we also had Apostle Tim Taylor, who's a part of a national or international effort, the New Apostolic Reformation. And they see changing contemporary Christianity in the name of their vision of what the first century church must have been like, and throwing out all the ideas of the offices of presidents and popes and general ministers and all that kind of thing, and creating a network of apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers, which are called for in the book of Ephesians. They see denominations as a barrier to a Christian unity, and doctrine forming the same kinds of barriers. And their apostles are they say, you know, directly in touch with God. And I've been present when some of their apostles have gotten words from God that he spoke to the congregation. And so the idea here is a complete transformation of society that would be organized under their idea, out of the mouths of the prophets, biblical law. So it's a revolutionary idea in its sense, right? Right in its essence, regardless of what kinds of political actions or military actions they ultimately take. So there's that group, and then there's the traditional patriot movement, that far-right factions who have been increasingly been the base of the militia movement that we know back from the 1990s. But also the most extreme elements of the anti-abortion movement that overlap these things. Used to be Operation Rescue and the Army of God has now become what we call, they call themselves, abortion abolitionists. Mm-hmm. So they think anything like the kind of regulations that are constantly being fought about in state legislatures, like waiting periods, that kind of thing, they see that as regulating murder. They want no part of any of that kind of legislative activity. It's outright criminalization or nothing. So these factions are all coming together and figuring out how can they fight democratic institutions more effectively to create the kind of Christian kingdom they'd like to see.
How do ideas like anti-abortion absolutism empower and bring together these figures?
Well, there have to be certain things they can agree on, and they have to see that they have to cast the state and the federal government as tyrants, as who are in defiance of God's laws and are imposing terrible evil on the people. So it's a populist kind of thing. But it's also a propaganda kind of thing to discredit the idea of the governments as we understand them as having any kind of moral foundation whatsoever, and they have to be destroyed so that what God or good, sound, decent thinking people would think of as a moral and steady kind of government. Mm-hmm. So that's what they have. That's what they're figuring out. What commonality they can find within that general idea.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the groups involved in this troubling scheming, Fred, both the known and the lesser known?
Well, some of them are well known already. We see the Oath Keepers, who are animated by a religious vision, as well as a kind of a Trumpist vision that we've seen at the insurrection in Washington. There's a particular religious group, they call themselves the Marble Community Church in northern Washington state that Matt Shea is very involved in. They have a practice of infiltrating and taking over specific congregations to get them under their auspices. So they've been a place where there's been paramilitary training on their compound. So they're a part of that. There is one larger grouping that also involves a variety of factions that I didn't mention in the story, and that's called the Redoubt Movement. And that's where certain kinds of conservative Christians are encouraging people to move to the general Pacific Northwest area so that they can begin to populate it, again, with the goal of forming a kind of Christian kingdom in the Northwest. We also mentioned the Project Blitz people and the New Apostolic Reformation people. Mm-hmm. So they're slowly finding their way towards each other in common political and military type action. Mm-hmm. Matt Shea and his friends had imagined a scene, perhaps coming out of the Malheur occupation or similar kinds of things going on, or ultimately they could break away a section of the Pacific Northwest and install a new government. And after the U.S. government finally falls, and Matt Shea would be the head of state.
Fred, in reading your report, it struck me that the earlier armed rebellions, if you want to call them that, such as the standoff at the Oregon Wildlife Refuge a few years ago, weren't all that different from the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Am I seeing a connection where there isn't one, or am I seeing pretty well?
I think you're seeing well. There were several other episodes of a similar nature. Before the Malheur Wildlife Refuge episode, there was also an episode at the Bundy Ranch, you may remember, where they have been using illegally federal grazing lands for years, and the feds were finally going to come and take it away. And so there was an armed standoff with militia groups, including the Oath Keepers, on scene, right? And ultimately, everybody stood down. So this kind of idea, the need for military confrontation with the government, has been going on for some time. And what's interesting to me is, I mentioned earlier, the militia movement of the 1990s that we're old enough to remember well. And the a lot of that was more defensive in nature. The groups were formed because they thought that the federal government was going to come and seize their guns. Mm-hmm. Of course, that never happened, but it created a fear and a defensive posture. What are you going to do when the feds come? But what we're seeing with these kinds of groups is a more offensive posture, and they've been slowly taking it in smaller bites and doing different kinds of contingency planning, making preparations on the ground, such as networks of private doctors to deal with casualties, communication systems to deal with field operations. They're slowly building a kind of capacity and infrastructure that could be offensive in nature and on a larger scale than we've seen before.
What is apostolic warfare?
Apostolic warfare. I think that would be the idea that we have these groups of people who think of themselves and others think of themselves as apostles. Mm-hmm. And they are the religious leaders in the new day, in the age that we're in now. So they're receiving direct revelations from God in order to take the country to build the kingdom.
And what are patriot churches?
Well, those it's a new thing that came out of the church that Matt Shea currently heads. His predecessor, a man named Ken Peters, had planted several churches in the East that are not tax exempt, right? They haven't sought or received 501c3 tax status, so they have none of the benefits, but also none of the restrictions. So they can bring together certain kinds of like-minded conservative Christians and advocate politically as they choose, seeing that as consistent with their religious vision, but also to organize militarily if they choose, all under the auspices of that religious identity. So there's one in Knoxville, one in Lynchburg, Virginia, and also another one back in Spokane.
I ask those because a lot of people who listen to those kinds of definitions don't take them seriously. I mean, they say, look, let's just laugh that one off. Don't worry about it. And so often a great strength of movements like this is that the mainstream fails to take them as seriously as they should until it's too late. Is that a possibility in this case?
Well, very much so. I mean, there's a sense in which we've always had certain kinds of militant fringe movements, and they come and go. But over time, what we've seen, you know, across a couple of decades is, yeah, there's a certain amount of coming and going, but there's also a certain amount of convergence and capacity building, common interests and intentions. And we're seeing more and more evidence of that, you know, from the creation of a new kind of protest church or political organizing church, to the kinds of insurrections we've seen in the Northwest and in Washington.
Frederick Clarkson is senior research analyst at Political Research Associates, together with Chloe Cooper. Fred has just authored a frightening report headlined convergence of far-right anti-democratic factions in the Northwest could provide a model for the rest of the nation. Fred, thank you for these insights, and I appreciate you being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Welton. You know, always glad to talk about these unfortunate things that we really must talk about.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week, one person for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.